It is 6 o'clock, and it is the first Thursday of the month, and that means that it is time once again for the monthly edition of the Post-Prison Education Program. And we are lucky to have with us live in the studios today, Ari Cohn, founder and executive director, president. I can't remember all the titles, but Ari, thanks for coming in and talking with us again.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So you have had, as usual, a very busy week. I wondered if you'd tell us what's been happening this week.
Well, you know, we Monday I was on Cairo FM talking about Facebook, which might be something that we should mention here, and because they did something that was hugely damaging to the nonprofit. And then yesterday, what is today? Today's Thursday, right?
So, it is.
So yesterday I was talking to, you and I were talking to Mark Stern, who formerly is Assistant Secretary of the Health Division of the Department of Corrections, about being on the show today or next month. And that conversation got me to thinking about topics, and I looked over to the left of my desk, and there were some color, high-quality Xerox copies of this check from Robert Crutchfield to me, which and I thought that's something I'd like to talk about, how that check came into being, and so here we are.
So for those that can't see the check, maybe you could at first describe it visually. And
yeah, there's I put it on my Facebook page, and we've got it on the Post-Prison Education Program Facebook page. But it's a cashier's check from Robert Crutchfield, drawn on WSECU for $5,000, made out to the Alliance for Fiscal Responsibility and me. And it's dated 12/20/2018. And it was written, it actually, you know, we have people with, we've been in operation for 15 years, and people come and stay, and people come and go, and some people get deeply involved with our students or with staff or both, and some people are peripherally involved. We had a Googler once say that he was involved because Googlers sometimes, in his mind anyway, live in a bubble, and he wanted to step outside the bubble and see what's out in our world. And but with people, what we found is people who are peripherally involved think they know about the post-prison education program, and they don't. They think they know about the students. They think they know about prisoners. They think they know about our budgets, and they don't. It's the people who get deeply involved. So one of the, we've spent the last 2 years financially crippled because of the situation that led to this cashier's check being made out to me. Most people think the program has been, has not been able to fund people coming out of prison to the extent that we would like, because Doris Buffett became cognitively impaired and her foundation ceased to fund. That's what people who are peripherally involved think. Maybe they read it on Facebook, maybe they read it in a newspaper, maybe they heard it with you and I talking about it on your show on KEXP or on a listserv, quarterly newsletter. But that's really far from the truth. And so I thought one thing that might be good to do today is to talk about some truths that people who are really deeply involved, not peripherally involved, know. And this is one of them. So, you know, in 2009, actually going back a little bit further, our funding is contingent on our effectiveness and whether we like it or not. And I don't even know if the Department of Corrections likes it or not or cares, but their success is measured on a rate of recidivism. For a while, it was measured on a readmission rate. And so if they're going to do apples-to-apples comparison, researchers have to check out the recidivism rate for our students, right? And, you know, I remember when I was really a novice at this and super naive, and Western Washington University was the first entity to come to me and want to research the effectiveness of the program. And I told them, you can't do it. And because I was thinking, how do you measure happiness? And I was so stupid back then, or naive, or whatever. What was Kennedy's, what was the whole thing called when Kennedy was running for president and became president? That was a period of time, right? It was like utopia or something like.
Oh, Camelot.
Camelot, right? So maybe I was like, in thinking the way people in Camelot might think or something. And so I thought the success of the program would be measured on whether people come out of prison and gain happiness. And I thought you can't measure happiness, so you can't research our effectiveness. And that's what I told Western Washington University. And then it was like people were coming out of the woodwork. And every time I'd turn around, somebody would ask us to be researched, right? And it's now called outcome data. That's what we call it. So, and I kept putting them off. But as I became less and less naive, and I was putting them off because I'd rather spend money on rent, housing, tuition, and books, clothing, treatment, and helping people release from prison than on fancy pants PhD researchers at the University of Washington or any damn where else, anywhere else. And so I just rebelled against that. So, but in whatever year it was when WAMU went under, like you went to bed one night and WAMU was WAMU, and the next morning it was Chase Bank, and the feds had taken it and given it away, and the whole economy was upside down, and I think that I shouldn't probably, my mother, that in one 24-hour period, lost $450,000 in the stock market. I mean, it, boom. And so Gregoire was governor. If you had any chance of getting funding from the state, you had to have data. And at the time, Eldon Vale was Secretary of the Department of Corrections, and I think I said it last time, and I said it on Cairo earlier this week. I think he's a really super savvy guy, and I had a really good working relationship with him and respected him, and so he could tell me things I didn't want to hear, and I respected him, so I would like accept it, right, which I don't normally do. And he literally, 7:30 in the morning, I'm at Raisin Bran and Bananas, and I've got the Secretary of the DOC on my phone talking to me about the importance of data. And he was like, if you have won any chance of funding from the government this upcoming session, you've got to submit the program to be studied by researchers. You have to have your effectiveness measured. So, long story short, I called, David Lovell was on our board at that time, and he was a UW researcher and research professor, and I called him up, and then we all met at the Barnes & Noble at U Village, where there used to be a bookstore and a coffee shop. And it was kind of like, okay, if the secretary of the DOC is calling me at 7:30 in the morning and follows it up with an email saying, you got to do this, then we got to do it. And we did. So we hired Lovell, and he had to leave the board. So we could, and then Lovell hired an anthropologist and who's now retired, and a PhD student, right, a PhD candidate. And they researched the program the last 2 months, the last 3 or 4 months of 2009, and then they reported it to the legislature January 15, 2010. And we had nobody recidivate. That's not pertinent to this story or this check, but which I'll just hold this up, by the way. Maybe the camera can get this. Mm-hmm. Does it?
Yeah, hold it closer to you.
Closer to me? Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, good. All right. And it's, again, it's on my Facebook page, but it's, so years later, it's time to do it again. And so in 2015, we had been talking, Doris Buffett, who was putting a lot of money into the program, Google and Googlers were putting, investing a lot of money in the program. And there was a lot of conversation, it's time to update that 2009 study. And so I reached out to Catherine Beckett, who's a professor here at UW, and she agreed to do the research, and then she had a family issue, and she couldn't. Her father died, his estate was in California, and she couldn't do it. She could do it a year later, but we needed it done then. And so we ended up with a board meeting. And at the time, we had like 13 people on the board. And a lot of them were friends and allies of mine. But one guy was married to, he's like a Mr. Mom, married to a woman who was vice president of Boeing, had been president of Boeing in Japan for 3 years, or made name as Weyerhaeuser, a lot of money. And I think because everybody knew that what that marriage was about, he had more sway on the board than any of the other board members, including me. And when we're having this meeting about who are we going to hire to replace Catherine Beckett, then Peter, I won't say his last name, but for people who know this, the nonprofit, know who I'm talking about. He was actually idiotic. I mean, David Lovell is who I wanted to do it. He'd done it in 2009. When he worked at UW, his salary was paid by the Department of Corrections. He was highly respected by the Department of Corrections. If you went to WISIP's website and you searched his name, you'd find many, many major research projects. He was just a not quite world-renowned, but a highly respected, well-known researcher, and especially in our field. And some of the most important research done for the Department of Correction had been done by David. And I wanted David to do that again. We had a working relationship. And Peter, when I'm in a crowded room, I pantomime this, and it makes people mad. But he was like, oh, no, his Ph.D. is in philosophy, right? We can't have somebody with a Ph.D. in philosophy. We need an icon, right? And finally, he got the board around to thinking, somebody suggested Robert Crutchfield. And I knew Crutchfield at the time. We didn't have a close working relationship, but I knew him. I knew his career. I knew he was chair of sociology, and somewhat iconic, right? And people at the table who also knew him better than I did sort of jumped on that. And I'm like, he won't do it. I'm telling the board, he won't do it. You know, he's stepping down as chair of the department. He's moving into retirement. He's on a plane half the time to St. Louis. He's very involved. He was very involved in the formation of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I said, I don't think he'll do it. And then it became like, well, why not try? And so I sent him an email, and he said, well, let's get together tomorrow. And I went out, came right out here, and met with him in his office. And I was right, because he said, I'll sign the contract to do the research, right? But I'm not going to do the research myself. And he had a PhD candidate that he had mentored for many years. And he said, if she'll do the legwork, then my name will be on the final report. And so I went back to the board and said, well, I was right and I was wrong, right? So he won't do it, but he'll put his name on it. And then this young woman agreed to do it. And she honestly, this is not an exaggeration, it turned out, she didn't even know the state's definition of recidivism. She truly didn't. She didn't know, when it came down to what we needed, she didn't know anything. And so, to make, we're 17 minutes into this already, so we're, to make a long, horrible story short, we extended the Catherine Beckett contract from June 30th to July 30th because Crutchfield came on a month later than Catherine had or would have. And the first problem was, and our board turned its back on David Lovell, who had been an original board member, a friend of Roger Goodman's, a friend of mine. I know his wife, and had done an excellent job, and he's respected by DOC. And by the way, David went on to be hired by Jerry Brown, who was one of the top researchers on Jerry Brown's staff in Sacramento, right? So the PhD being in philosophy didn't matter to people who really knew what the heck was going on. But as we got into all the technical with it, I mean, it's really, doing this research is expensive because you're paying fancy pants PhD researchers money. But it involves multiple state agencies. So you have to get a data sharing letter from the Department of Corrections. That has to go to WISIP, which is the Washington State Institute of Public Policy, which is the research arm of the legislature. And you're trying to get the DOC's data uploaded to WISIP, and then from WISIP to our researchers, right? And then you have to get the administrative office of the courts, which is this teeny tiny little agency that almost nobody knows about, but it sits on top of every court in the state of Washington, non-federal. It's the executive director reports to the chief justice. It's a super powerful agency, AOC administrator. They have to sign a contract with the researchers on how the data will be handled and how privacy laws will be protected. You see, and the first thing off the bat was this young woman was clueless. I mean, I could get really negative with this, and I'm not going to, but aren't you glad? So I just, for those who were on the other side of the camera, you just went like this, right? So, but she couldn't get AOC to sign off, right? And we're almost like 2 months into the deal, into the work, and the data hasn't even been uploaded to the University of Washington yet, right? And so we had to go back to the guy who my board had turned its back on, to David Lovell, and when Peter, the guy that became this burdensome problem that, in essence, nearly destroyed the program with his actions, when he came back, it was like, well, we got to get David Lovell to help with this. And I'm like, you know what? You call him. You were the one that kept him from being hired. You call him, because I'm not. And so Peter called David and talked us into another $10,000 that had to be added onto the $30,000 contract. And then Lovell came on, and I think it took 2 days for him to get work out the deal with the administrative office of the courts and clear all the way for the data. So then the data gets finally uploaded, I think on August 14th, to UW. Then they go to work on the data. And we start seeing errors right away. And these were horrible errors where this young woman was classifying non-students as students and classifying people as having recidivated on our watch when they were actually in prison when we met them and they weren't, you know, they weren't our student yet, right? And I mean, there's the one that struck me when I got this initial spreadsheet from Crutchfield's assistants. The thing that struck me was a name jumped out. Several did. One was a guy, Gina McConnell-Otten, whose file is this. You know Gina. Her file is this thick. We spent a bucket of money on her. And actually a movie was made that won an Emmy, and she sort of became the star of it. And they had her classified as zero level of service, not a student. And conversely, there was a guy whose name I didn't know, and they had him as level two or three high level of service. And I didn't know the name, so I was pretty sure he wasn't a student, pretty sure he hadn't gone through the scholarship committee. And when I pulled his file, it was paper thin. That's because we never did anything. I mean, his file came in, and for whatever reason, it went straight to archives. We didn't write him. We didn't email. We didn't talk to him. There was no activity in the database, nothing. But they had him classified as a student. And that determination is really important because if you're a student and you recidivate, that affects our how we're looked at, our outcome data. And conversely, if you're not a student and you recidivate, I won't say we don't care, but it doesn't impact our data. So we had these names sticking out that were just wrong. And so our antenna went up in the office. And then we got a spreadsheet. It sort of became famous. And we, just looking at it, Michelle Conley and Bronwyn Huback and people, highly intelligent people, Michelle MSW from Columbia, Bronwyn was a lawyer, with a social justice heart as big as Manhattan, and you could just look at the spreadsheet off the bat without going back to the files, you knew it was mistaken. And so we had somebody move all these files into one of the offices, and then the three of us sat in there, Bronwyn and Michelle and I, with laptops and desktops and the database open and QuickBooks open. And we audited those 500 or 600 files one by one, and nobody could classify them without consensus by the other two, right? And we found a 20% error rate. 20% error rate. And it just kept getting worse and worse. And so finally, in November, the board met. We were meeting every week at that point because this was like an expensive proposition. And we needed the results because, frankly, it was the end of the year when Google has Giving Week, and we flat out needed to get that data out to people at Google. I knew about what the percentages were going to be, but we needed it confirmed, right? So we're getting all this bad data when we need good data, and we need completion, and we're not getting completion, and we're months behind. We meet the board's meeting weekly, and finally, I think it was Elizabeth Hendren, who's an attorney at Northwest Justice Project, made a motion that we fire Crutchfield. The Post-Prison Education Program Board asked the Alliance for Fiscal Responsibility, which is the research arm which had the contract with Crutchfield, to fire him. And then somebody else seconded it, and the motion carried. Everybody voted to fire him, except Peter Hayman wasn't in attendance that night. He was at home. He missed the board meeting. It was his birthday. His mom was in from Montana, and he forgot to pay the gas bill, and they were cooking birthday dinner on Coleman stoves in their kitchen, right? And so, but the next morning, he went wild, and he tried to get the board meeting to reverse their decision, right? And so getting to this check was one of his arguments was that if you fire him and don't continue to use him, then he'll sue. And then I'm like, so what? You know, we've got data up to here, and it's their data, and it's audited, and so what? Let him sue. And Peter was right. He did sue. And the end of this story, which has now taken 26 minutes of our half hour, was if you're sued, you have to defend yourself. If you just lay down and die, they'll get default judgments against you. And then they can move to take your property. It's just that they can come into your office, take your computers, take your office furniture, conceivably take your files. They can take your everything. And so you have to defend yourself. And so so we had to defend ourselves. And I shopped the case, and people were scared of it because it was research, it was data, it was intensive mounds of paperwork, file cabinets of paperwork. It was complicated. And finally, somebody recommended Farron Curry at Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt to me. And she agreed to take the case, right? And the long and the short of it was that it took we had $140,000 out of the nonprofit's pockets, which should have been spent on tuition and books and housing. And you've seen how we spend our money. You know, the office is important. That's where students and prisoners and former prisoners come to. There's a sense of community there. So there's our rent, there's students' rent, bus passes, grocery cards. When somebody relapses, inpatient treatment at $5,000 a month. That's where that $140,000 should have been spent, and it wasn't because of this contract that we had with Crutchfield. So we finally went to trial. That there were attempts at settlement and attempts at mediation, and we went to trial, and I'm going to read you an email I got from Farron Curry on March 26, 2018, and she sent me the order from Judge Smith ordering Crutchfield and his lawyer, Thaddeus Martin, sanctioning them to pay this penalty of $5,000, which, in, you know, it should have been $140,000 or $400,000. It was ridiculous that she sanctioned them at $5,000. But she wrote, plaintiff's claims against Mr. Cohn individually were frivolous and advanced without reasonable cause. I'm going to read it again. So the judge ruled plaintiff's claims, and the plaintiff was Robert Crutchfield, were frivolous and advanced without reasonable cause. Anybody wants to see that court order, I'm more than glad to provide them a copy. And then she gave them a period of time to write this check, and then one day the $5,000 check arrived. And so there's maybe 50 copies of this sitting on my desk, and I saw it this morning, and I decided I wanted to tell that story because people who are peripherally involved don't know why we've been financially strapped the last couple of years, and I think that they should know. So that's that story.
So that clearly seriously caused you to be, I wouldn't say crippled, but held you back severely. Is that the worst thing that's ever happened to post-prison education program? What are some other things that you're wrestling with? Because
The worst thing that happened was a seriously mentally ill student who we helped immensely. We kicked her out of the program because she violated our standards. And at the time, I think she was the first person we'd ever kicked out of the program. And I'll come back to that story. But the worst thing maybe that has ever happened to us hasn't happened yet, but it's sort of in process. It's sort of like if you're standing on the train track and you see the train coming and you're maybe tied to the track, and you haven't been hit by it yet, but you know you're about to be hit by it, right? And that's what's happening with us right now. So one of the things, if we did a 10-hour show and I brought 50 people in here, we couldn't adequately address the animosity and the ignorance that the public and the voting public have about prisoners and former prisoners. The people, I think nationally, but certainly in this state, and from the governor on down, and his advisor Sonia Hallam, people don't understand who we've got locked up, and so we've had for years problems with landlords because building owners don't want they don't want a nonprofit that brings prisoners and former prisoners into their building. They think that's dangerous, or they think it will hurt their ability to lease to other people. So we got to the end of our last 5-year lease in the central building where we were for 14 years, and we had to move. And if we couldn't find a landlord that would take us in, the post-prison education program was out of business, period. And so in October, a realtor with Keller Williams found this place in Soto, right? And Soto's cool. And this building is one block east of the Soto Link light rail, so I love that. And the rates are so much lower in Soto than downtown Seattle that was a major factor. And so we leased it. And we picked up more space. We went from 1,800 square feet to around 3,000 square feet for less money than we were paying the owners of the central building. But we moved into an empty space. If you go to the Post Prison Facebook page, there's pictures. Click on photos, and there's pictures there of what it looked like when we moved into it. It's an absolutely filthy, dirty, bare wood, bare walls. You could see through to the first floor through the flooring. No electric. I mean, literally, no electric. No cracked windows. No ductwork. No HVAC. Literally nothing. And we had to. I'm gonna make this quick. We had to so it had to be built out, right? And so our lease required that they build it out, like have HVAC, for example, heating and air conditioning. Simple things, right? But it was also build out the office spaces. So we were able to say we want this office to be 12x17, and you know, here's where the walls would go, and the bathrooms and the kitchen, and here's the bullpen common area, and so on. And we moved the last 3 days of December. We moved into the building, and it was wintertime, and it was cold, and HVAC had not been even the HVAC units had not even been placed on the rooftop yet. And in fact, it was the 15th of March, almost the end of winter, maybe 3 or 4 days before spring, right, when the units got put on the rooftop of the 624 South Lander building. It's right at 6th and Lander. And then there was some kind of permitting issue. And it took about 2 weeks to get permits to run the electric to the HVAC units. And so finally, the first week of April, the HVAC units were actually heating, right? But by then it was time to air condition. And when they came on, it was out of control. The work had been done by people that didn't know what they were doing. And, you know, the first hint that I knew that something was wrong, we had an amazing contractor. If anybody ever needs cabling, like Cat 3 cable upgraded to Cat 5 for cable drops for Wi-Fi and VoIP telephone systems and all of that, I can recommend a guy who's amazing. And so the first time he walked into the space, right out of his mouth, I mean, first thing, he asked me, what about permitting? And later I asked him, why did you ask me that? And he said, because I was looking at Romex cable, I have never seen Romex be approved for commercial installations anywhere in the city of Seattle ever, not once. And so that was the first clue that maybe these guys, that the billing manager, a guy named Adam Simon and his company's Real Assets, something or another, was doing this build out work without getting permitted. And then we get into April, and it was comical. It wasn't comical. We had a meeting with the foundation on March 29th. The office was so cold and we couldn't control it that we had to adjourn the meeting to Starbucks headquarters, for real. And then if you get the bullpen area at 72, then the student services office would be so hot we had to bring in a portable air conditioner to cool it. And the adjacent office, the executive director's office, would be so cold that we had to have a space heater in there. So the HVAC was out of control. And we counted on these people for 9 months to do this work and to get it right. And after 9 months, we were done. And so we got involved with lawyers, and you know, every time we do that, it's not an exaggeration to say that will cost somebody's life. Somebody will recidivate, go back to prison, overdose, commit suicide. Somebody's life will go down the tubes every time we spend money on lawyers, because it could be better spent doing other things. So anyway, the lawyers suggested that we didn't suggest, just flat told me we need to get a competent HVAC company in to evaluate what was wrong. So I reached out to CBRE, who I knew from the central building, and a manager at Cushman Wakefield, and I asked, these were two of the largest property management entities in King County, and they're respected and they're reputable and nationally known. And I asked them to recommend bona fide, licensed, reputable HVAC companies, and they did. And one of them was a company, I didn't know it's used putting their name in there, but we asked one company to come over, and they did. And they actually spent two visits in the office evaluating what all was wrong. The last visit, the tech brought the president of the company with him. And this guy's standing in the office, and he asked me about permitting. And he just flat said, you know, we're going to give you a quote, which ended up being $13,000 to fix the mess that exists in the office right now. But we can't do the work unless it's permitted. And he says, my opinion is if I call in City of Seattle construction and inspection people to permit this, they will, quote unquote, red flag the building, and the building will be closed. Probably all tenants will be out, and it'll stay closed until the owners bring the envelope of the building, I don't even know what that is, up to code. So interior, exterior, wiring, all of that up to code. So at that point, we had to have the HVAC fixed. So I called I called the City of Seattle Department of Construction Inspection, which I didn't even know existed before because my degree is in political science, and talked to a lady and described what was going on, and they sent an inspector out, and he's confirmed what the HVAC contractor told me. And it's talk when you talk about the guy standing on the track in front of the train and the train's coming, I think this building is going to be red flagged. And until the owners bring it up to code, I think we and other tenants are going to be locked out of the building. And so that's going to prove to be the demise. I mean, that could be, if they red flag the building next week and we're locked out, the post-prison education program will cease to exist. If it's 2 weeks from now, the post-prison education program will cease to exist. We've got 23 trunk lines, servers, firewalls, switches, desks, furniture, files, and if we can't access those things, we're out of business. If we're not in the office answering the calls coming in from the prisons, we're out of business. And that looks to me like it's coming. And there's nothing we can do about it. It's like the building owners will fix it or they won't fix it. And you know, maybe now's a good time to talk about who will get hurt by that. So I'm 72 and I'm tired, right? Really, 15 years is too much. And I'm tired of fighting for funding, and I'm tired of fighting with government agencies, and I'm tired of, I love seeing people graduate and succeed, but I'm tired of the, you know, when you, the suicides and the overdoses so it won't hurt me. It'll hurt people who are applying. We get 10, 12 applications in the mail a day. The phones don't stop ringing in the office. And it's prisoners and former prisoners desperate to get their lives together. Really desperate. And you've been in the prisons with us before, so you know. It's and you've met so many people. And they are desperate. And a lot of them, you know, look, if you're in prison and you make friends, you make friends for life, and you make friends at a higher level than friendship on the street is. It's just a different situation. Friendship is defined in a different way among prisoners. It's like, I don't know if this is carrying it too far, but when I was locked up, I had two really close friends at this disciplinary prison I was in up in northern New York, SCI Raybrook. And if I'm a friend for them, I'll die for them, right? And the other way around, you know, you'll do whatever, you do things for your friends in prison that aren't even an issue, aren't even on the radar on the streets. And so I don't even know how I got on that topic. I got a little emotional, I apologize, but I'll have to go back and watch this and see how I got on that friendship tangent. But anyhow, I'll retire, right? And the program, I was talking about people applying, right? Mm-hmm. And what they tell us is that, I mean, this is what the deal was. Now I remember. I'm senile on top of 72. But so, like, you're in prison and you have a dinner in the housing unit because your friend's releasing in the morning, right? 6 weeks later, you see him back on the yard, right? In DOC, it doesn't happen that way, but in the feds, it does. And so in DOC, they're in the jail, and then they're over at male intake or female intake. But at some point, you know they're back. So people that are locked up in the Department of Corrections, they know the people are coming out and dying. They know that they're overdosing and dying, that they're dying from suicide, that they're recidivating, because they're seeing it, and it's because of their close friends and they're tracking what's going on, and so their hopes and dreams are wrapped up in these applications. I've had people talk to me about how much time they spend sitting in their cell writing the personal statement that comes in with the application. All that's lost. You know, I suppose what would happen is I would send Steve Sinclair, the secretary of the DOC, a text saying, I need to talk to you, and then I would tell him that the program's closing and why, and followed up with a formal letter, and call Comcast Business, tell them to turn the phones off. I guess that's how it's done. I mean, I've never envisioned that, but that's where we're at right now, because this building manager, a property manager, apparently, I'm told, has done all this build out inside the building, all this construction, all this wiring, building rooms, putting up walls, HVAC, without getting permits, in violation of more laws than you can shake a stick at. So that's something that's come up really fast. It hasn't been a 2-year battle like the mess with Crutchfield was. But it's come up really fast, and it's something we have no control. I can't call funders and say, you know, we just had to pay a lawyer a bucket of money, $50,000 retainer, $25,000 retainer, whatever. So help with a fundraiser. It's not a money issue. This is you're locked out of the office issue, and you're locked out till the building's brought up to code. And we have no control over it, none.
Do you know for sure you're going to be locked out, or is there potential for a window to move stuff out to another location?
Well, that's why there is no other location. First of all, there's just no other location. I'll tell you a quick story. So Don was on the show a couple of weeks ago with Joe Jensen, and our previous 5-year lease in the Central Building, when it was getting ready to run out, because we were there for 14 years, Dawn and I were very aware, she was managing director of the program at the time, we were very aware that the lease was running out. We had to find another location because the Central Building's owner at that time was not going to renew the lease. At a point, we had 3 commercial realtors looking for places that would let us move in. And they couldn't find any place. There were vacant places all over. The one that sticks in my mind is sort of a historic building. It's down on the waterfront now that the viaduct's gone. It's the Prudential Building. The guy's building was empty. I mean, Dan got near 100% empty because of all the pounding and the cranes and all the noise from the construction with the tunnel and everything. And he was trying to fill the building up, get tenants in, to the point that he was offering $11 a foot. When downtown Seattle was $28, $30, $35, he was offering $11, but he wouldn't take us. We offered him a 5-year lease. We said, we'll pay for all the build-out. And the realtor showed him media. You know, if you Google R.A. Cohn post-prison, we've got so much positive media. I mean, Emmy movies and documentaries and newsprint. It's almost KEXP interviews. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so but nothing would sway this guy. His hate of prisoners and former prisoners, which I'm sure just came out of ignorance, was so great that he wasn't going to have us in the building. And 2 owners ago in the Central Building, the reason we had to move this last time was. The building was 50% vacant, and this company down in Southern California, huge REIT, multi-billion-dollar REIT, KBS, the senior VP in charge of the property believed that when they were bringing tenants into the building to have them be new tenants, prospective tenants, that them seeing the sign post-prison education program, that, you know, would cause them to not lease. He firmly believed that us being in the building would hampered his ability to fill a 50%. And so it's really, it's unbelievable. And so that we couldn't move. I'm sure if we spent 6 months, but we almost spent $50,000 moving. I mean, it was the cabling, the Cat 5 cabling, the 56 cable drops, the switches, moving the servers. That was $7,400, just the cabling and the switches, right? The IT, the moving of the servers and all that, $15,000. The three moving trucks and eight movers over 3 days, I don't even know what that was. But it was almost $50,000, moving the phone system. We can't afford to do that again if there was a place to move to. We just did it. We can't do it again. So no, we can't move. And we'll see what happens. You know, we'll see what happens. But that's it. But it's just, I called Jenny at the last minute yesterday and said, you want to be on the radio show? And we've been trying to get her on, but she's a mom and she's getting ready to start UW, and she's an honor student from South Seattle, and she's a supervisor of Catholic Community Services. And so she says, why do you always call me at the last minute? Right? But you know, when you look at people who, with whatever, either a lot of assistance or little assistance, what they've done with their lives because of us, really, that sounds conceited. Every time I say something like that, it sounds conceited to me. It doesn't feel right. But you know, you've got people like Keith Whiteman, Jenny. And on, you know, Shelley Clearight, just on and on and on. Shalisha Hudson was just on the show the other day, that have been in prison. They're recidivating machines. That's what Keith used to call them. You know, the reason the anthropologists got hired in 2009 was the legislature wanted to know, why does the insanity stop when the post-prison education program gets involved? I mean, why does somebody come out, recidivate, and do it for 15 years, six different times, and then the post-prison education program enters their life and the insanity stops, right? And I know why that is, and when Mark Stern's on the program, on the radio show, hopefully next month, if we're still around, then we'll talk about that, because he and I have somewhat different ideas on treatment and what's effective and so on and so forth. But it's those people, the applicants and the students, that'll pay the price of this. And that's sad, because if we've proven anything, it's that 9 times out of 10, according to the last research study, which, by the way, got concluded after we fired Crutchfield. I worked with Anna Marie Kelsey to find researchers, and our contract was with the University of Washington, not with individual researchers. And the data, it came out, were 92.1. Our students were 92.13% successful. Our recidivism rate is 7.87%. The Department of Corrections just jumped again to 33.5%. And so it's the people who will go back, who will die, who won't have anybody. They won't have a phone number to call. They won't have an answer. You know, there'll be nothing where there used to be hope and too little assistance, but more than they ever got from the state, there'll be nothing. So that's the price.
So what can people do, people who are listening or watching, what could they do?
I don't know.
They know of realtors or, you know.
No, well, I mean, I just don't. If you come to the office, it's a really complicated. It's a complicated office. The firewalls and the servers and the cable drops and the switches. It's and the phones. 23 trunk lines. The 800 line that rings in from the prisons just doesn't stop. It's one call after another. And I just think it's impossible. If the building gets shut down and the red flag and the owners react quickly to get it up to code, and maybe we're locked out for 2 weeks, then we can just, maybe we'll ask the Department of Corrections if we can work from the CJC, or maybe we'll talk to Anna Maria about borrowing some office space at UW for a couple weeks, and we'll talk to Comcast Business about rerouting phone calls to cell phones or something. I don't know, but moving is just, it's not an option. It's just, it's too big, too complicated, too horrible. But so in the past, it's always been funding. You know, it's money would solve any problem we've ever encountered. In this case, this guy, I'm told, has broken the law. You know, he's done major construction in this building, mechanical construction, HVAC, electrical, and without permits. And the law requires that work be permitted, and then after the work's done, be inspected. And that didn't happen. So it's like it's out of our hands. We'll see. I don't know. I don't know. I've actually never been in a situation like this before, and I've been in some bad situations, and we'll see. The guy and his property management company broke all these laws with permitting, and the city's going to react, you know, and we're just sort of the bystander with a lot of futures on hold. I don't know. We just you met McKenna and Marla a couple months ago, the Seattle Academy interns that we had in the office, and they just, as I think they described, they just went, we worked with me and Josh and Shalisha to call applicants, you know, and again, we took a whole bunch of applications and reduced the number without ever interviewing these people. It's just a matter of too little money to meet the need. And but the applicant student services office is full of applications. You know, and I challenge people to come to the office for as long as it's there and sit down and read applications. And, you know, like Marla, I remember her saying it. It was like she put yes on everyone she read. I'm like, Marla, you can't do that. You have to say no to somebody. We can't fund this, right? But every applicant we have is compelling. And if you believe the UW research results, 9 out of 10 people that we help would build lives that are really spectacular. And I was telling Dave Ross the other day on Cairo about, I kept talking about this 40 felony guy who'd been to prison 6 or 7 times. It's Keith Whiteman. I didn't, and I told so many stories about people like that Dave said, I want to interview some students, right? And so I gave him 6 or 7 names, and they interviewed Keith the other day. So these are high-value people, and their futures will be dramatically impacted depending on what happens in the next couple of weeks.
So how can people connect with you to support or to come and look at the
The office address is 2450 6th Avenue South, Suite 200, 6th and Lander. So easy to get to. Just take Link Light Rail, get off at Soto, walk 1 block east. And my email is re.cone@postprisonedu.org. The website is www.postprisonedu.org. The office number is 206-503-2300. My extension, the phone on my desk, is extension 1001. That's it.
All right. Well, if nothing else, we'll have a show with you again next month.
Yeah, and hopefully Mark Stern will be here.
All right.